So we remind ourselves of where Joseph is at the start of this story. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. Anyone here been to a theme park recently? Alton Towers, somewhere like that? No? They're always inventing new instruments of torture and torment. I've heard that Alton Towers, there is one roller coaster where you're whirled around and twisted and turned in complete and total darkness. So you can't see a thing while all this happens to you. You don't know what's coming up in front of you. Oh, horrible. There's another one that apparently takes you slowly up a slope. Then you hover at the top, and then it plunges you vertically, face down at high speed, for hundreds of meters, into a smoke-filled hole in the ground. I have never seen the attraction myself. This whole theme park, you fork out vast sums of money to spend most of your time in interminably boring queues, surrounded by screaming children, and then when you do get to go on the ride, it sounds absolutely horrible. You go up and down and round and over and under and in and out, and you don't know whether you're up, down, coming or going, and when you get off, you feel like throwing up. I just don't need it. Firstly, I've got a weak stomach, and secondly, it sounds rather too much like the rest of life to be any fun. Because life with God, life as one of his people, can sometimes seem like an overlong visit to a theme park with a roller coaster enthusiast on August bank holiday. A strange mixture of tedium and then torment. And I'm sure that Joseph would have agreed. His experience is the archetypal roller coaster ride, isn't it? Up in Canaan, down in the slave market, up in Potiphar's house, down in prison, then up again in the prison office. But the important thing to notice that this journey is a journey with God. And at last God is starting to make his public presence felt on the action of this story. Remember, he's hardly been mentioned up to now in the first two chapters, and look what a mess they were when people were left to their own devices. But now we find it being said very clearly, the Lord was with Joseph. There in the beginning of the account, verses 2 and 4. The Lord was with Joseph, it says, there at the end of the account, verses 21 and 23. And so that's our theme for this evening. What can we expect if the Lord is with us? People sometimes casually use it as a greeting, don't they? The Lord be with you. Well, they used to anyway. I wonder if they know what it actually means, though. Presumably, if the Lord, the God of heaven and earth, is with us, it will be a blessing in the end. But it doesn't mean that we're in for a smooth ride. If the Lord is truly with you, then I reckon you can expect a bit of a roller coaster. And that roller coaster will include triumph and temptation and trouble. We'll find all three in this story, won't we? If God is with you, you can expect triumphs. You can expect success in one way or another. We see the roller coaster lift Joseph smoothly up into the air to the pinnacle. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar puts him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything that he owned. Joseph was successful. In this country, we're notoriously bad at handling success. Lack of practice is probably the main reason for that. We normally avoid the difficulty simply by avoiding success altogether. And if, by some fluke, success should arrive in our lives, we all, quickly as we can, undo it as fast as possible. The world is full of successful foreign companies making money from excellent British inventions, isn't it? The world is full of victorious sports teams who were fortunate to play us just after we'd beaten someone else. We seem in this country to find success a bit embarrassing, something to keep quiet about. We prefer to proclaim our steady, boring mediocrity, or even our well-managed decline. And sometimes the same can be said for British Christians and churches too. Because there are a lot of reasons to beware of success, aren't there? Beware of triumph. Often it's measured in superficial ways, or trumpeted by vainglorious means. Sometimes the wrong connections are made, as if faithfulness to God guaranteed success, or lack of success in your life indicates that God is displeased with you, or success in your life automatically proves that God is blessing you. None of those things are true. Those are false assumptions, false connections. But nonetheless, success is not dirty or unspiritual. If God gives us gifts and abilities in whatever field of endeavor they may be, from very humble to very grand, he does expect us to use them with all our might. All things being equal, it is reasonable to hope for success in doing that. Rightly understanding, of course, what true success is. But there are all kinds of reasons why we can expect successes if God is with us. For a start, you yourself work harder and better because you're doing everything for him. You yourself have the benefit of his wisdom, which teaches the best way to do things, doesn't it? The Bible contains a lot of this wisdom in Proverbs and all over, in fact. And then there is the fact that God does honour and reward faithful service. Now, of course, in the Old Testament, that was mainly seen in the earthly perspective. In the New Testament, we have a heavenly perspective on life. And that warns us against living for the here and now, against measuring the level of God's blessing on our lives by how well things go in this life. Nonetheless, all things being equal, God still does bless and honour those who seek work to work faithfully in his name. And we find that in the New Testament. For instance, we find in 2 Thessalonians, Paul prays for the success of the enterprises of the Thessalonians that they undertake in faith to God. So, of course, we look for success, for triumph. And, of course, God's granting of success to his faithful servants, his faithful people, is one way in which he chooses to bless the rest of the human race as well. We see that in these verses, don't we? Verse 5. From the time he, Potiphar, put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. Potiphar and the rest of his household did well from Joseph's qualities and service. We hope that the UEA will do well because of Paddy's service, and Norwich Union will do well because of Reg's service, and wherever you work will do well because the Lord has put you there and equipped you as a faithful servant. So it's right to expect success, to expect triumphs in the Christian life if God is with us. Now we're going to be saying a lot more about this next week, so we'll move on for now. But let me just encourage you that whatever gifts or opportunities the Lord gives you, do set out to succeed and make the most of them. Be modest before others, but don't be shy when opportunity comes your way. But do be aware. If God elevates you in any way, it is firstly for his glory. It is secondly for other people's good. And it is thirdly so that he can bring you down to earth with a really good solid bump at the end of it. At least, it was for Joseph, wasn't it? End of verse 6. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." It seemed almost too good to be true, didn't it? The stuff of dreams. To rise from the slave market, from the pit in Canaan, in fact, to the estate manager's office. But now that roller coaster has levelled out. The curve has plateaued and is trundling slowly towards the drop. If God is with you, there may well be triumph, but there will certainly be temptation. There will be testing. It's not an if, it's a when. It's a whenever, in fact. We follow Christ, don't we? And Christ received personal attentions from the devil himself. Joseph foreshadowed Christ. And though he was important in God's plans, he didn't get the devil in person. He got Mrs. Potiphar, who frankly sounds nearly as bad. We mustn't conclude from this text that the Bible is misogynistic. That is, that it's saying women in general are the wicked temptresses of poor men and bring so much evil and trouble to our world. Some Christians have concluded that. Read what people like Augustine had to say, and it's embarrassing. No, that's not what we conclude. That's not the case. Women in general are not the wicked temptresses of men who bring all the trouble into the world. But this one was. And we too will find ourselves in situations where spiritual disaster yawns in front of us. What will we do? Well, let's understand what temptation is, first of all. According to Tim Rice's lyrics, Potiphar's wife was beautiful but evil. Beautiful but evil, he says. But those are two assumptions, really. First, it doesn't say she was beautiful. You notice that? It doesn't actually say she was beautiful. She could have been absolutely ghastly. Joseph's flesh might have crawled at the sight of her, for all we know. And if that was the case, the temptation before him was less about lust on his part and more about standing firm when somebody with power over him was putting the pressure on. However, I do think it's reasonable to suppose that going to bed with her was not a totally unattractive prospect for Joseph. After all, the charge of attempted rape was a credible one, and one assumes that a rich man like Potiphar in that day and age could have his choice of the available wives. And remember Joseph's state at this point. He's in his early to mid-20s. He's been unmarried up to this point and a slave since the age of 17. And I ask you, chaps, what single topic do you suppose was most on his mind at this point in his life? So I think we can assume that there was plenty in Joseph that really wanted to do it. Many years of frustration, perhaps, and pent-up hormones said to him, "Go on, Joseph, now's your chance, go for it." And that's the whole point of temptation. You really want to do it. You really want to do it. Sometimes people think, well, temptation is something that should just be like water off a duck's back for a Christian. No. The point is you really want to do it. You want it a lot. Something inside you might be screaming and begging for it and saying you can't do without it. To be tempted and yet to resist is a form of suffering. Show me a person who never suffers through temptation, and I will show you a person who has never resisted temptation. Hebrews tells us that Christ himself suffered when he was tempted. He saw those stones in front of them. The devil said, "Turn them into bread." He was hungry. He wanted it. But he said no. The other assumption that Tim Rice makes is that she was evil. And of course, what she does is very wrong. But it's not helpful to picture her and the sources of temptation in this world, in general, as some kind of cartoon vampire. Now, I admit, come to bed with me, that's a pretty direct chat-up line. You know, not a lot of preamble there, is there? But remember, it's only a summary. Maybe Joseph would come across Potiphar's wife in other circumstances too. When she's vulnerable and lonely and small. Potiphar's away on a business trip, she says, again. I'm sure he's got a mistress in Memphis. He's got no time for me these days. And all I want is just a little bit of affection, a little bit of company and love. Or maybe she'd been kind and warm and supportive to him. They'd had a sort of friendly relationship. Joseph's far from home, he probably misses his mum. Maybe they enjoyed a friendly giggle and a cheeky joke together. We needn't think that she's some vampire who jumps out of the woodwork with it written on her forehead what she's there to do. Because most sincere Christians who fall into sexual sin do not do so when some brazen hussy or some hair-chested gigolo pounces upon them. That's not the normal experience. It's quite a rare occurrence, actually, at least in my experience. And it's readily seen for what it is. Normally, disaster strikes, if it does in a Christian life, when some emotional bond develops over time. Remember the importance of mind and emotions in this that I was talking about last Sunday morning. Maybe the context is that you're supporting someone through their difficulties, or working with them, or socializing with them, or even praying with them at church. And over time you find something developing and growing between you that gets a grip that you can't get hold of. And it's more than a moment's frustration to say no to it. And when he or she says, come to bed with me, it's not out of the blue when you're strong and ready to face it. But it comes at you at a time when you've got everything inside you wanting to say yes. Do not underestimate the power or the subtlety of such temptation. We might read this story and think, oh, well, I could say no to that. Doesn't take it too hard to say no with, you know, this kind of thing. But no, that's not the case. And why should the enemy send a demon from hell to get you when an inoffensive human being, maybe another Christian human being, will do his job much, much better than he ever will? But maybe she was just a vamp. Maybe she was just out to notch up another innocent on her bedpost. That's a possibility too. Such people do exist, don't they? In Joseph's case, the difficulty is compounded by the fact that although he's important, he is a slave. So she, as the boss's wife, has real power over him. And that, of course, weakens his resolve, doesn't it? He could argue that this was coercion, that it took the moral onus off him because he had no choice but to give in. I was only obeying orders, he could have said. His own sinful nature could have grabbed hold of that and said, well, you've got no choice, have you? How can you say no to her? What will she do if you say yeah, if you say no? And it may be, too, that we find ourselves in situations where somebody can exert real pressure over us, and our own conscience is weakened because of that. It may not be because they have actual power, but sometimes you can get in a situation where you feel an obligation to go along with another's wishes. Ruthless individuals may manipulate our emotions to go along with what they want, so that we feel like we really ought to, even if we don't want to. How many girls have been caught out by that one, eh? And even if that's not the case, normal human beings nonetheless can unconsciously manipulate us and use us and get us to the point where we go along with something that we don't really want to. And that's one of the reasons why we always encourage younger Christian people particularly to not go out with people who aren't Christians. But any of these situations, though, remember, temptation itself is not the sin. Doesn't matter how much you're tempted if you don't sin. However, temptation tugs at our hearts, however strong its pull is. Only you decide whether you follow it. The material circumstances of your life may well be a bit like a roller coaster over which you have no control. They take you up, they take you down, and you can't get off, can you? Your moral conduct is not like that. Your moral conduct is more like the Dodgems. You do have control. Although, admittedly, the steering wheel can be a bit dodgy sometimes. You can get spun around, you can get stuck in the corner or shunted from behind. Nonetheless, you do have your hands on the steering wheel morally, don't you? Now, of course, you could never possibly survive alone in that. And you need the help of God. Remember that 20% of the Lord's Prayer is about being protected from evil and delivered from temptation. And we forget our need to pray about that at our peril. But in terms of the practical steps whereby we put this into action, well, we've got a lot to learn from Holy Joe, haven't we? We need to resist temptation by both our attitudes and our actions. Our attitudes to ourselves, first of all, verse 8. He refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns has been entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. Have a care for who you are, too. For the duties and the dignity and the privileges that you carry. Regardless of anything else, if you are a Christian, you are a child of God. You are a brother of Christ. That's who you are. Respect that fact. You also may be a leader, a parent, a trendsetter for others, a boss at work. You have influence and status, perhaps. Like Joseph, like Christ himself, God has given you a calling and a place in his plan. You should respect yourself. The world's lie is that to cast off your moral restraint is the way to be free. Do your own thing, assert yourself, be more of a person, it says. Rubbish. To follow that path actually belittles you, destroys your humanity, makes you less of a person. Your highest freedom is to please God with what you do. And nothing will affirm your dignity as a human being more than to do what is right in God's eyes. You notice that God did not give moral laws to rats and monkeys, did he? He gave moral laws to human beings made in his image. It marks us out as special that we can do or not do what God says. Attitude to yourself, attitude to others. Carry on in verse 9. He says, my master has withheld nothing from me except you because you're his wife. Joseph had a duty towards a man who had entrusted a great deal to him. The shame of betraying that trust would be mortifying for Joseph. Not to mention the other servants in the house who looked up to his integrity and depended upon him. When you are tempted, weigh the consequences of your actions to other people, to those you know you will let down. And weigh those consequences, whether or not you think they will ever actually get to know what you've done. Because it's an incredibly valuable thing to be able to look people in the eye, isn't it? How much is that worth? But most of all, it's the attitude to God that counts, isn't it? How then could I do such a wicked thing, he says, and sin against God? And if the other things don't count, surely this one has to. How could I do such a thing and sin against God, he says. Who knows how bad this would be. Nowadays, words like temptation and sin are normally applied to such grievous crimes as eating an extra chocolate eclair. They're so made to feel like they're trivial and don't really matter. But remember what sin means to God. Sin flogs the skin off Jesus' back. Sin drives thorns into his head and iron into his hands. Sin mixes the blood of the Son of God with the dirt of the earth and leaves him naked and pathetic on the cross, crying in the dark for his Father. Does that bother you or not? Can you really walk away from perceiving that? And still play lightly with sin in your life, like it's a game. Don't you feel shamed by the pain that it causes Christ? And afraid of the anger it evokes from God? Joseph did. How could I do such a wicked thing, says Joseph. Even the thought of it is giving him the shivers, isn't it? Shudders down his spine. How could I do such a thing as that? I don't know if you ever get that experience, you know, you're in company, in church, somewhere like that, and you simply imagine doing something really embarrassing. You don't actually do it, you just imagine doing it. I do that all the time. And just the thought that you might conceivably do it makes you cringe inside, even though it was just in your head. Surely I'm not the only person who's ever been in that situation. Well, the point I'm making is that's how we should feel even about entertaining temptation in our minds. Even the thought that we might do something like this against God should make us shudder inside, whether or not, even though we never get there. So resisting temptation starts with attitude, but in the end that can only be half the battle. Action must match up to attitude, and here I'm very deliberately going to reprise some of the things I said last Sunday morning. Notice first, and very obviously, that Joseph says no consistently and forcefully when tempted. Although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her, it says. He stuck with his line on the matter. It was clear and unambiguous, although tested repeatedly. He doesn't even enter into negotiations on the subject. Don't you do that either. That's what Eve did, do you remember? When she was tempted, she didn't just say, no, that's wrong. She sort of enters into a negotiation. Yes, well, maybe there's one side to it that I haven't thought about. Disaster. No, when you're tempted and you know it's wrong, stick with your line and do not negotiate. Don't aim to meet halfway. Oh, I won't do that, but I will do this. He didn't prevaricate. He didn't say, oh, maybe later, and hope she never came back. She did come back, because temptation nearly always does. Don't feel bad of yourself if temptation does return, because it rarely takes no for an answer, and you can't stop it. Say your piece whenever you're called to do. Joseph says his piece as much for his own sake, I think, as for hers. Because strongly saying no to temptation, actually verbalizing it, writing down your reasons for not doing something, may not persuade the tempter to go away, but it will help to keep you persuaded, won't it? Persuade yourself. Second, he avoids the temptation. Did you notice that? He refused even to be with her. Verse 10. Morality did not require that of him. Wisdom did. Steer clear of that woman, said wisdom. Remember what the Lord's Prayer says. Lead us not into temptation. Not to give us strength to resist it, but lead us not into it in the first place. And that's unquestionably the best strategy, isn't it? Don't even give yourself the chance to give in. But don't assume that those measures will always protect you, because an occasion will come where you've done your best to resist it, you said no consistently, you've done your best to avoid it and tried to avoid the situation, but then in the course of your normal business, it jumps out and grabs you, gets its fingernails under your skin. Do not despair when that happens. There remains one time-honored course of action, frequently used by the most courageous and noble of saints, to great effect. Scarpa. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Brothers and sisters, when did you last do a good old-fashioned bunk? Run away from a situation. Because knowing when to run away, just drop everything and head for the door, is a vital spiritual survival technique. Think, I just got to get out of here. It's a very important thing for a Christian to be able to do. It's not cowardice, it's wisdom. Apart from anything else, you know that whatever the temptation, God has promised that there is always a way out in a tempting situation. Trouble is, we don't always take it fast enough. But Joseph did. And so his integrity is preserved. And his example, of course, applies to many temptations of all kinds. But in today's climate, we must notice that it's particularly appropriate in sexual matters, isn't it? Most of the well-built young Josephs and Josephines in this room this evening are going to be tested on this at some point in their lives. Nowadays, it's almost certainly the area in which you will come under the most moral pressure and the area which will most distinguish you from the world if you stay true. If God is with you, you will certainly experience temptation. And even if you resist that, or maybe perhaps because you resist that, you will certainly experience trouble as well. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard my scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." Verse 19, when his master heard the story his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me," he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And so, the roller coaster plummets vertically down into that black, smoke-filled hole in the ground. And all over again, Joseph has been plunged from the heights into the pits. And let's remember why these troubles have befallen him. They have happened because God was with him, not against him, but with him, just as much as his triumph and his testing. If Joseph had been an ordinary boy, he'd still be happily back in Canaan. If Joseph had been an ugly boy, he'd still be happily back in Potiphar's house. If Joseph had been a bad boy, he'd still be happily back in Potiphar's bed. But look where all these blessings from God, his abilities, his looks, and his integrity, look where they've got him now. And if God is with us, rest assured, we will have our troubles. And not in spite of being a Christian, or regardless of being a Christian, but because we're a Christian. There's many reasons for that. If God is with us, we may experience trouble as a punishment, as a chastisement for our past mistakes. He always forgives our sins, but because he loves us, he may not let us escape their consequences. I know Christians who, in the past, made an awful mess of their relationships or their finances, and now they're lonely or poor, and they're crying out, "Oh God, why is this happening? It's not fair. Why am I suffering like this? You're supposed to bless me." The reason they're suffering is because God is with them, and the Father disciplines the children he loves. One could well argue that Joseph's first downfall to the slave market was at least in part a result of his own cockiness and foolishness. But second time round, that's not the reason, is it? Joseph did everything right this time, yet once again he's in the pits. And this too may happen to us. If God is with us, he may bring trouble as a preparation for the future, as well as maybe the consequences of the past. Because Joseph, we know, has a grand future ahead of him. God has great plans for him. But like all the great saints of the Bible, he had to be prepared. Think of them all. They're all prepared one way or another for their role. And that includes Jesus Christ himself. Jesus Christ, according to Hebrews, had to learn obedience through what he suffered so he could become a perfect priest who helps us and meets us in our need. Jesus knew why he suffered, but very often we don't know. And so you find yourself thinking, "Lord, I'm sure that this is meant to teach me a lesson. I'm sure it's meant to teach me a lesson," we pray when we're in trouble. "Please tell me what the lesson is, will you? Then I'll learn it." Anyone else thought that? Joseph did not know what the point of his troubles was, I'm sure. He'd had those dreams that had pointed to a grand future, but nothing more concrete than that. But maybe if he had known why he was suffering in this way, then that suffering would not have had the same effect. What if every night Joseph could comfort himself in prison with this thought, "I'm here because God is getting me ready to save millions of lives in this forthcoming famine. I'm going to be second in command to Pharaoh himself. That's what I'm going to be. Wouldn't it be nice and comforting to know that? Except, if he had known that, maybe he would not have learned the lesson that he needed to, which was one of humility and of patient trust. If God is with us, we will have trouble. Chastisement for the past and preparation for the future. But there's something more as well. Our troubles will also achieve something in eternity. And I think that's foreshadowed at the end of our text. While Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him the kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warder. So the warder put Joseph in charge of all those held in prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warder paid no attention to anything under the Lord Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. The Lord, in his wisdom, presumably knew that for Joseph, the route from Potiphar's house to Pharaoh's palace would go via the prison cell. But that was the best route, maybe the only route, from A to B. And in our lives, I warn you, we may never see that. It's important that we don't skip on too quickly from verse 20 to verse 21. Because in the Old Testament era, there was little knowledge of eternity beyond death. It was not generally revealed. And so if God were to prove his faithfulness, it had to be in this world and in this life. Hence we find that in some Old Testament stories, there are happy endings, which can seem a little contrived compared to our present experience. Isn't that so with the book of Job, for instance? Many Christians are left in their equivalent of Pharaoh's prison until their dying day, and only find out later why. Don't get me wrong, if we're suffering in this life, if we're struggling in troubles, we may seek God's help for it. In fact, we must. And he does bring relief to our troubles. He can change situations. This text does encourage us to seek that. But it doesn't promise us that we'll receive it. Verses 21 to 23 do not promise happy endings in this life. They point to a resurrection for the next life. There's an eternity ahead of us. And we know that not through Joseph, but through Jesus Christ, who suffered on the cross to open up the door to our heavenly home and win our place in it. We see in him how his pain, his wounds, his grief achieve something eternal for us. And as we follow in his footsteps, our troubles, our grief, our pain, our suffering, if offered up in his name, achieve something eternal. So we may not know the reason why we have troubles, but we know at least that there is one. And knowing that is not cold comfort. It's not mere pie in the sky. When we see terrible things happen, things like the terrorism in Spain, we see afterwards people leaving their tributes and their flowers and their cards by the roadside or on the railings. I wonder how many there are now outside that station in Madrid. Very often you see on those cards and flowers a question. Oh God, why? Why? Says that question. And of course, no answer comes. No answer comes. If God is with us, we may cross that question out. It's no longer the most pressing question, because we know its answer will one day become clear in good time. Instead, we cross out, oh God, why? And we write, oh God, when? When? How long, oh Lord? Because we know for sure that one day Christ will return. And he will bring all these troubles, all this sorry mess, to its rightful conclusion. And the really urgent question in our mind is not now to try and fathom the why, but to long in our hearts for that day. And it's not pie in the sky when we die. We're not saying, oh well, forget this life, it'll be all right in heaven. Because eternity is not merely an escape from the present. We're in fact saying, somehow, eternity is the result of our troubles in the present. Our troubles today count for something, achieve something that lasts forever. And we know that because Paul put it this way in Romans. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal.